Today is Wednesday, August 16th. We're going to cover some basic chemistry today. All right, so page 4 starts basic chemistry. A lot of the stuff in this chapter is presented from a high school chemistry course perspective, so we're not going into great detail with chemistry in this chapter. Since there's a lot of terminology in the chemistry chapter, I collected all the terms and put them here on the top of page 4 for you. That way, when you're going back to study, you can take a quick glance, see if there's anything that you might need to review, since there's a lot of stuff in this chapter. So why don't we start with the definition for matter? I'm sure you've heard of matter and mass and all this good stuff before. We define matter as what?
Anything that takes up space.
Anything that takes up space, right. So we definitely fit the bill for matter, right? We take up space. How about the air that you breathe? Yeah, that takes up space. Sure does. So pretty much anything on Earth is considered to be made of matter because it does take up space and has mass. Only items in a true vacuum would be lacking of matter. But, you know, for our intense conversation, we're talking about everything we discuss to be made up of matter. The relationship between matter and elements is that elements make up matter. That's, of course, the stuff around us. And elements are here on this periodic table, and they're organized by atomic number. We know of over 100 different elements at this point. Several are man-made. But if we move toward the top part of this periodic table, we'll actually find elements that are common to our bodies. And that's really the point of our whole conversation.
Is there any way to make that stop moving or not?
I have asked. Yeah, it vibrates constantly with the air conditioning in this building. Yeah, I'm so glad I'm not having to look at it. I hate it for you guys, though. Yeah, it's like a give-you-headache inducement. Okay, so what is an element? How would you define an element? Good, yes. Simple substance composed of the same types of atoms. You cannot break an element down into anything else. You know, a couple hundred years ago, people didn't understand the concept of an atom, nor did they understand the concept of an element. And there were some pretty smart people that thought they could take things like lead, which was pretty common in the environment, and eventually transform it into gold. You know, and they worked their hearts out trying to get that transformation to take place. But nowadays, we know that there was never going to have a transformation from something like lead into gold. We know the basic foundation of an element is an atom that builds that particular chemical, and it can't be changed into something else or broken down into something simpler. That is the simplest substance that we're dealing with. All right, so on your sheet there, you've got a list of common elements. The top four are C, H, O, and N. You can call them CHON for short, or you can call them what else?
Honk.
That works, yep.
What's the other?
CHON, C-H-O, and N.
Uh-huh.
You can call them honk. So it's interesting to note that about 65% of your bodily weight is composed of oxygen. You know, I don't really feel all that lightweight. You know, more than half of me is oxygen, but I'm not floating away. So it's not gaseous oxygen. How is that oxygen present in your body? Water. Yep, it's water. So oddly enough, around 65% of your body is water, and so that kind of goes hand in hand with the amount of oxygen that you've got. So yeah, it's tied up as a water molecule. Of course, carbon is important for building our organic molecules. Things like carbs, lipids, proteins are made from carbons, and hydrogens are often used to make those organic molecules as well. So just something to think about, why we have so much carbon and hydrogen in our bodies. Nitrogen is a smaller portion. It is important for making proteins like your hair and your muscles. It also is important for making amino acids that build those proteins, as well as nucleic acids. You'll want to read through the rest of the chart. Are these elements and their symbols familiar to you? Okay. If you're not conversational in these, you'll want to make this part of your to-do list for the next week or so, especially looking at those that are tricky. Potassium with a K, And
iron.
On which one? Iron, yeah.
Sodium.
Sodium, yeah. Yeah, so just pay attention to those weird ones. They're named for their Latin names, and that's why we have strange things like K is a symbol for potassium, and you're right, iron is Fe, and sodium is Na. Okay. You may want to read through the list of why these are important in our bodies. We're going to talk about them throughout both Bio-210 and 211, so we'll eventually uncover why each one of these is important for us. All right, any questions on that first page? Let's talk about atoms on the next page. This is top of page 5. So what is the relationship between an atom and an element?
Elements are made up of atoms.
Elements are made up of atoms, good. And is it just any old atom? Is it varieties of atoms?
No, it would be the same types.
Same types, good. So when we're looking at elements and we say, okay, this particular element, excuse me, is made up of the same type of atom, we need to look and explain what that means. So we need to look more on a subatomic level and explore all the parts to understand why atoms are unique to a particular element. All right, so we've got three primary subatomic particles, protons, neutrons, and electrons. You've had this before somewhere, right? Okay. Hoping that'd make the jumping screen a little less worse, but I think it had no effect. So. Just want to make sure you're comfortable with atom structure before we go forward. We know that protons and neutrons are housed together in the nucleus of the atom. So what would you describe the nucleus as?
Like the control center of the atom, or like the center of it?
The center, yep. So it's like a condensed area in the center of your atom. I'm just going to pick some numbers here. Let's say that we're dealing with an atom that has three protons. We can put 3 with a plus there, or we can write 3 with a P. Okay, your choice. Let's say that this atom also has 3 neutrons. We can write 3 with a little zero symbol there. That means what?
Neutral.
Good. No charge, neutral. Or instead of that little degree symbol, we can write N for neutrons. So together, the protons and neutrons make up the mass of the atom. They're going to be sitting in that centralized nucleus, and they are surrounded by electrons. So what are electrons sitting on?
Orbitals,
good. These orbitals are going to be electrons moving around the nucleus at the speed of light. And so in the innermost orbital, we're going to only have a small bit of space. And because it's a small bit of space, how many electrons can we place there?
Two.
Just 2, good. It is just my personal habit to put a negative sign inside those electrons. Just keeps me straight that electrons have a negative charge. So because we have a very tight orbital here, I can only place 2 electrons in the innermost orbital. That happens to satisfy a rule called the duet rule. How many are in a duet?
2.
Yeah. So 2 is the max, and we've also satisfied that duet rule. Told you this particular atom had 3 electrons. What should I do with the 3rd one?
Put it on the next orbital.
Put on the next orbital. Good. All right, If you take a moment to confirm, I do have 3 total electrons, 2 placed in the innermost orbital, the leftover in that outermost orbital. By the way, we're going to call our outermost orbital the what? Good, good. That's our valence shell. So let's go ahead and label that outermost one as our valence shell or valence shell. So our second orbital here has a little more space. In fact, it can hold up to how many electrons?
8.
Good. And in fact, 8 is also the maximum we can hold. That means if we do have 8 there, we have satisfied what rule?
Octet
rule. Good. So let's make a note here. So that valence shell that we're looking at has a maximum of 8 electrons that can be held. That, of course, if it's full, would be the octet rule that we have satisfied. I kind of think of this like a sports car in a minivan, right? Sports cars hold 2. Not a lot of room in that innermost orbital. Minivans are bigger, they hold more, so the further out you go, the more electrons you can place. Now, there is something new about this octet rule. Starting with this second orbital, and the further out you go, third and fourth and so on, you only need 8 to consider having a stable atom. So that's our magic number, that's what we use to create a stable atom. So even if your orbital can hold, say, 18 electrons, all you need is 8 to satisfy the octet rule and say, check, this is a stable atom. So from the second orbital on, we're going to use 8 as our magic number. That's going to be our number for stability. Okay, well, let me give you one to try. Let me give you a moment to draw out this one somewhere on a little edge of paper. While you're doing that, I'm going to send around the attendance roster. Okay, so what did you place in the nucleus?
The protons and neutrons.
Yeah, protons and neutrons, good. So we'll stick those 8 protons, 9 neutrons in our nucleus. We've taken care of the hard part, right? All right, now we're going to distribute those electrons in the innermost orbital. How many of those 8 can we place?
2.
Just 2, good. Well, we filled up the innermost orbital, but it looks like we have, what, 6 left? Okay. So let's do another orbital. How many of those 6 can we place on this orbital?
All
6. All 6. Good. So that valence shell has 6 electrons. Would you consider it to be stable?
No. Needs 8.
Needs 8. Good. So it did not satisfy our octet rule. So we would say that this particular atom is not stable. Okay. Do you feel pretty good with the atom that you drew? Do you feel comfortable with it? Okay, do you need another one, or do you feel comfortable moving on? Moving on. With another one? Keep moving. Gotcha. Okay, so just for reference, the two rules that we're working with are the duet rule for the innermost orbital. That means that the innermost orbital can hold a maximum of 2 electrons, and that stabilizes our innermost orbital. In most cases, though, we're going to have more than 2 electrons, so we spill over to more and more orbitals, but we only need how many to create a stable atom?
A.
A, good. And the name of that rule?
Octet
rule, good. Introduce another term. We've talked about stable atoms. Let's talk about neutral atoms. And when we're talking about the term neutral, we're not necessarily talking about neutrons. We're talking about the charges in the atom. So let's go back and review. What particular subatomic particle carries a positive charge?
Proton,
good. And negative charge?
Electron.
Okay, so if I get something to equal out, that means I've got even numbers of protons and electrons. So if you take a look at this atom here on the left, we have 8 protons. Count the total number of electrons.
Ten, yeah.
So is it neutral? Now, because you would expect to have equal numbers of positive and negative charges, but we don't have that, do we? We've got 8 positive charges and 10 negative charges. Check this one on the right. Is it neutral? So how do you know it's neutral? Yeah, so that one has 10 protons and 10 electrons. 10 positives cancel out 10 negatives, and so we've got an overall neutral atom. So all neutral means is that we've got equal numbers of positive charges and negative charges. You know, when you're working with the periodic table, just assume that the atoms on there are neutral. That makes life a lot easier if we just make that assumption. Back to our term we were discussing earlier called stability or stable. Let's take the atom on the left. Would you consider it to be stable?
Yeah.
How do you know?
Yeah,
8 electrons in that valence shell. So yeah, we check that box and say, okay, we've got ourselves a stable atom. We satisfy what rule?
Octet
rule, good. How about the atom on the right? Is it stable?
Yes.
Yes, good. So the opposite of stability is to be a reactive atom, and neither of these fit that bill. The one we drew first, over here with 3 protons and 3 electrons, it would be considered a reactive atom. So I'll just make a note here that this particular atom we drew first with 3 positives and 3 negatives is neutral, but it's also reactive. Questions so far? Feel pretty good so far? Okay. All right, just give you a moment here to check out these two atoms. We are looking for the atom that is stable. So what are you looking for?
Eight
in that valence shell, satisfy that octet rule. So do either of these atoms check that box?
Yeah.
First one,
good. So it does have 8 electrons in the valence shell. The one on the right has only four, so we would not call it stable. Instead, you'd call it
reactive.
Good. While we've got these two to take a look at, check out the atom on the left. Would you consider it to be stable? I'm sorry, neutral.
Yes.
So it has how many positive charges?
10.
And of course, 10 negative charges. Good. The atom on the right, is it neutral?
Yes, it is.
Yeah.
Six protons, six electrons. Good. So in fact, both of these are neutral because they have equal numbers of positive and negative charges. Okay. If you feel good, we'll move on to the next page with atomic numbers and mass. That's on the top of page six. You have an ID number here at the college, and that ID number references you. The atoms on the periodic table kind of work in a similar way. The atoms that belong to a particular element also have an ID number, and that ID number is called the atomic number. The atomic number of an atom is always equal to the number of protons in that atom. So if you look at the one on the left here, we were just talking about this one. It has 10 protons, therefore the atomic number is 10. The atom on the right has six protons. The atomic number for that atom is six. So that makes it really easy if you've got an atom that's all drawn out to look at. The number of protons always equals the number for our element, so the atomic number. Something else to consider here, if you've got a neutral atom, and that's our assumption that we're working with neutral atoms, what does the number of protons always equal?
The number of electrons.
Yeah, number of electrons, good. So if I say I've got an atom with an atomic number of 10, and I've got 10 protons, you automatically assume that there are how many electrons?
Mm-hmm.
Got 10 as well. Good. So if you don't have a drawn out atom to take a look at, maybe you've got the periodic table. The periodic table may have a number of bits of information in there that we need to look at. So there's two numbers typically in each box for the atoms on the periodic table or elements there. Y'all good? Anybody else need to sign in?
Okay. Oh, I'm sorry.
Okay, so is it the bigger number or the smaller number that's your atomic number on the periodic table?
The number.
Yeah, in this example, it's the smaller number, which is sitting on the top left-hand side. I wouldn't memorize that it's on the top left because every periodic table publishes a different place. So I would just keep in mind that your atomic number is the smaller of the two numbers. So let's leave hydrogen alone. It's kind of an oddball, right?
Yeah.
Okay, well, that's an exception to the rule. Let's take calcium, for instance. It's got a 20 sitting there. That's the atomic number for calcium. Let's see, we've got sodium with Na. It has an atomic number of 11. On this portion of the periodic table, we've got carbon. What's its atomic number?
Six.
Six, good. So knowing that we've got an atomic number of six for carbon means that we have how many protons?
Six.
Six, good. Let's do nitrogen. How many electrons in a nitrogen atom?
Seven,
good. How did you know that? Good. Atomic number is seven. The protons are seven. You assume it's a neutral atom, so that means the electrons are seven. Good. Let's say oxygen. How many protons in an oxygen atom?
Eight.
Good. Is that ever going to change?
Yes.
No, never going to change. Because if I add a proton or take away a proton, it changes the element, exactly. So we're not in the business of changing protons. That is directly tied to the element that you've got. Okay. Let's talk about the mass, and I'll go back and look at an atom for just a moment. The mass is equivalent to the numbers of protons added to what?
To the neutrons.
Neutrons, good. So if you take a look at the nucleus of your atom, in this one on the left, you've got 10 protons and 10 neutrons, and the weight is
20.
Good. Okay. So you ever wonder why they don't include the electrons in the calculation?
They always try to find a way to the nucleus.
And the predominant weight is the nucleus, yeah. You ever get on the scales and weigh, and you say, oh my God, that cannot be what I weigh? And you strip down naked, and you get back on, and you say, it is what I weigh. You ever do that?
Yeah.
Okay, so that's what an atom does. An atom weighed with the electrons or without the electrons weighs about the same. So electrons don't contribute a whole lot, just like our clothes don't contribute a whole lot to our weight. So, of course, we don't bother to count them in when we tally up the weight of that atom. So atomic mass is protons plus neutrons. Thank you. Anybody else need to sign in? Okay. Let's see. We've got on the right-hand side an atomic number of
13.
Atomic number is
6.
Yes, 6. And the weight or mass?
13.
Good. Let's do another one. How about the weight or mass of a sodium atom? 23. I know that's kind of blurred, isn't it? Yes, so sodium has 23 for its weight. Okay, let's see if we can get another one. How about the weight of a nitrogen atom? 14. Good. All right, so there's one thing we've kind of left out of our conversation, and that's the neutron, right? So we've talked about an easy way to get the proton number, the electron number, but how do you figure out the number of neutrons if all you have is the periodic table?
By subtracting the atomic number from the weight.
Good. Take the atomic weight, subtract off the atomic number, and that's going to give you the number of neutrons. Sometimes it's the same as your atomic number, but don't make that mistake of saying it's going to be the same. You know, nitrogen has 7 for the atomic number. That means it has 7 protons, 7 electrons. Do the math, 14 minus 7 gives you also 7 neutrons. Yeah. But that's not always the case, you know, so we don't want to fall in that trap of saying it's always going to be the same. Let's do another example. Let's take phosphorus, for instance. How many protons in phosphorus atoms? 15. Good. And electrons? 15. And neutrons? 16. Right. Subtract.
There's still one more.
There's still one more, yes. So you got to subtract that. 31 minus 15. All right. So any questions on how to figure out protons, neutrons, electrons, atomic number, or mass? Just to make sure you and I are on the same page, let me give you a couple of minutes to do problems 1 through 4 at the bottom of your page. And if you don't have a course pack, that's okay. You may want to lean in on maybe a neighbor and take a look at what they're doing. So we're looking at numbers 1 through 4 on the bottom of that page. Let's run through those first 4 together, make sure you feel okay. The first practice problem there says we've got an atomic number of 5. I'm going to assume this is a neutral atom, so that automatically tells me what else is 5?
Protons,
electrons. Good. Okay, so I've got to figure out the neutron number, and I do that by subtracting 5 from the 11, so that gives me 6 for the neutron number. Good. Let's see, our second problem there, we don't have the atomic number, but we are given the protons. There are 11 protons, so what else is 11?
The electrons.
Electrons are 11, and the atomic number. Yeah, atomic number is 11, good. All right, and we have what, 12 neutrons? Good. Did you do A-OK with problems 1 and 2? Okay. Let's see, number 3, we've got a carbon atom. It has 6 electrons. How many protons?
6.
And atomic number?
6.
Also 6. And it just happens to work out that the neutrons are also
6.
6. Yeah. Yep. All right, and number 4, Let's see, this time we've got our atomic number of 3. That means the protons and electrons are also, you got it, 3. And the mass?
7.
It's going to be
7, good. And you got that from doing what?
3 and 4,
good. Protons added to the neutrons, good. If you looked ahead, did you see any questions you need help with?
Can we do 9?
Sure. Okay, number 9 has 4 protons, so I automatically know neutral atom, this is 4 electrons. Atomic number is 4. Good, and neutrons?
5.
Yep, so subtract away your 9 minus 4.
Okay.
Okay, any others there you'd like to go through? So you want to work these until you kind of do it in your sleep. You know, it just wants to become something like second nature to do this. And then when you get to that point, then you're good to go. Anything I can address about protons, neutrons, electrons before we move on to isotopes? Okay, at the top of your page, you'll notice that there's a definition there for isotopes. And you'll notice that what they have in common is that they are atoms of the same element. Because they are atoms of the same element, that means they're going to have the same number of what? Protons. Yes, same number of protons. Notice what differs, though. They differ by their numbers of neutrons. So let me give you an example of some isotopes. Okay, for starters, can you confirm that these are all atoms of the same element? I know it's written at the bottom, right? Okay, but if you didn't have that written at the bottom, what would you be looking at in each atom to confirm they're all atoms of the same element?
Protons,
good. So because each one has 6 protons, you say, these all must be atoms of the same element. If I change the neutron number, have I actually changed the element the atom belongs to? No. If I change the electron number, I still haven't changed the atom, or the element, rather, this atom belongs to. That proton number, though, is critical. That has to be the same for us to say these are isotopes. So that's what makes an isotope an isotope. They have same numbers of protons as other atoms in that element that just happen to have different numbers of neutrons. So when we count the total weight for each atom, that is also something that varies. Notice this one's called carbon 12. What does that mean?
6 protons and 6
neutrons. Yeah, 6 protons, 6 neutrons, that's your weight or your mass. And that's exactly what we've got up there. Carbon 13 shows us not 6 neutrons, but now this time 7. Yeah. And then for carbon 14, we now have 8 neutrons. So it's just the number of neutrons that varies per atom. It doesn't change that the atom is still a carbon atom. It just happens to be a different number of neutrons. You've probably heard of radiocarbon dating, like they find a skeleton maybe 1,000 years old, and they say, hey, this skeleton lived, you know, back in the 1200s or back whenever. And so during time, different numbers of isotopes are more common in the environment than others. So you may wonder why in the world we're talking about this for human AMP, and it has to do with radiology. I know some of you said on Monday you were going into the radiology program. How might isotopes be useful for you? So let's see. Somebody has gallbladder trouble, and they want to know if their gallbladder is clogged up with stones. Okay, so they can use a radioactive dye to see if that gallbladder will squirt out its, you know, bile. Somebody else may have heart trouble. They may want to see if all those vessels around the heart are open and pumping blood. Inject a radioactive dye and see if those vessels conduct the blood. So the radioactive isotopes that are used in nuclear medicine nowadays tend to decay over a certain period of time. usually within a few hours, not within a few days like they used to be. But that's what we talk about, isotopes. You may be working around them someday, either in a radiology environment or in a testing or diagnostic environment. Okay, so any questions about isotopes? What do they have in common? Same protons, they're all atoms of the same element, and they're different because of the numbers of
neutrons.
Good, and that makes their mass, yeah, makes their mass different. Good. Okay, I will leave the rest of page 6 for you to practice on if you want to practice. Page 7 and 8 also have more practice. I need to caution you that there are isotopes mixed in on page 7. Ready for chemical bond formation. Woohoo! This is a great way to review what we just covered. Let's start off with neutral and stable. Okay, so we're going to ignore the after picture over there on the right. We're going to focus instead on these two atoms on the left-hand side of this picture. And you'll notice the two atoms on the left-hand side of the picture are both what? Are they both neutral or stable?
Neutral.
And you know this because? Yeah, three protons, three electrons means that atom on the left is neutral, and its buddy sitting here has 9 protons and 9 electrons. Good. So you've got 2 neutral atoms. So the problem with these two atoms is neither one is stable. And you know this because you're looking at what?
Looking at electrons.
Electrons in which shell?
On the outer shell.
Valence shell. And that is the innermost or outermost?
Outermost.
Outermost, good. All right, so that is the issue. These two atoms want to be stable, and so there's an easy way for us to do this. In an ionic bond situation, an atom transfers an electron or more than one electron to its neighbor to create two stable situations. I colored one of these electrons red so we can follow what happens to it. If we transfer this one single lonely electron from its orbital to the neighboring orbital, it's a win-win situation. So let's take a look at the after picture. Now, do we have two stable atoms?
Yes.
Okay, the one on the left only has an innermost orbital with 2 electrons. What rule does it satisfy?
Duet.
Duet, good. And its buddy on the right satisfies what rule?
Octet.
Octet rule. Okay. So you may not see the before picture, you may only see the after picture, and so we want to appreciate what's happened here. Now, we started with 2 neutral atoms, but that's not what we ended up with. What charge does an electron carry?
Negative.
Negative. So if I give you a negative charge, you now have an extra negative charge. That's what's happened to the atom on the far right. It received an extra electron, and so now it carries an extra negative charge. It is no longer called a neutral atom. It is now called a
negative.
Right, an ion. Right. And what type of ion?
A negatively charged.
Negatively charged.
Anion.
Good. That's right. Let's see, I think your vocab list in lab has A or an as a prefix. A lot of textbooks define it as without or negative. Negative is good because that, of course, is what charge an anion carries. So anions have gained an electron, at least one. And they carry a negative charge. So we're no longer going to call the two on the right neutral. They are not neutral. They've gained or lost electrons. So the one on the far right with the 9 positive protons in the nucleus has in fact become an anion. This is a type of ion. So the atom on the left there with the 3 positive protons in the nucleus lost an electron. The old saying goes, it's better to give away than to receive. And so it lost a negative charge, leaving it with an overall positive charge. So we are going to call that one a cation. And you may remember that one because the T can be kind of looked at as a positive charge. So it has lost electrons. Losing that electron or more than one electron, we've got an overall positively charged atom. Okay, so a couple of things to summarize about our ionic bonds. Ionic bonds result from the transfer of electrons. The goal of transferring is to satisfy or stabilize the valence shell. What results is not neutral atoms, but actually what we call ions. And we have a cation that has lost one or more electrons, transferring those electrons to an anion that has gained those electrons. So we end up having stable atoms, but they're no longer neutral. Big deal. Stability is much bigger of an issue for these atoms. All right, so these have already experienced the transfer of an electron. This is the after picture, so to speak, after the transfer has taken place. For a moment, just count the charges on the atom on the left. There's 11 positive protons. How many negative electrons? Looks like, what, 2 in the innermost, 8 in the next, so 10 total?
So that's positive.
That's positive, yeah, it lost an electron. And if things go like we expect, the atom on the right should have gained an electron. So just double check the charges there. 9 positive protons, but how many negative electrons?
10.
So that's where the electron went, was to the neighbor. So that alone should be enough to confirm and say, hey, we've had a transfer of electrons here. That must be that we've got a cation on our left, anion on the right, okay? And of course, these are going to be attracted to each other because of that transfer of charges there. All right, could you spot a cation or an anion if I gave you a bond like this? Not yet? Okay. What if I put a positive charge over the one on the left and a negative charge over the one on the right? Would that give you a clue?
Yeah.
That's a good clue, yeah. Look for that as well. So when we write these, we'll oftentimes put the little charge as a superscript to illustrate that we've either lost or gained electrons. I should mention that ionic bonds break apart in water, and they break apart into what we call electrolytes, and they're great at conducting electricity. So in our bodies, we know we need electrolytes because we need them for hydration, for maintenance of muscle charges, neuron charges, and it has to do with these ionically compounded molecules that we see here. I'll come back to ionic in just a moment and let your brain rest from that. We'll go into something a little different. These are covalent bonds. All right, so what if you took the two atoms here in the left picture and you let them transfer electrons? Would this be a win-win situation?
No, one atom would lose every electron that's got in the other one, would just get any one.
That's right. So one atom would be a loser, it would lose its only electron, and the neighboring atom would be a winner because it would get a stable valence shell. So it doesn't look like a great situation to do a transfer in this case. What if we were to allow those electrons to share in a pair? Would we stabilize both valence shells?
Yes.
Yeah. So the word covalent means what?
Sharing of electrons.
Yes, sharing together electrons. So you can see co is together or with. Valent means valence shell. So we allow those electrons to be shared in pairs, and they fly at the speed of light around each nucleus, and they spend time orbiting each nucleus. Sometimes those covalent molecules experience an equal sharing of electrons, and if the sharing is done equally, we have a name for it.
Nonpolar.
Nonpolar, good. That is a nonpolar covalent bond when you have electrons shared equally. All right, by contrast, if you share electrons unequally, what do we call that?
Polar.
Yeah, that is a polar covalent bond. If you have some chemistry, you may have heard the term electronegativity. It has to do with the greediness of a particular atom for electrons. And in the case here, we're looking at a water molecule with a very greedy or electronegative oxygen atom. Oxygen is a big atom, and compared to the two hydrogens it's sharing electrons with, it's kind of like a kid on the playground that says, you know, I want those toys, and it's a big bully, and you take the toys, right? So oxygen says, I want the electrons that are being shared with me, and I'm going to pull them really strongly. So the pairs of electrons that orbit this valence shell for oxygen actually spend more time orbiting the oxygen nucleus and less time orbiting the hydrogen nucleus. All right, so we got a setup here for kind of a tug of war game going on. So, what charge does an electron carry?
Negative charge.
And if the electrons orbit the oxygen nucleus more frequently, that's why you have a slight negative charge there. If the oxygen is getting most of the time with the electrons, and these poor old hydrogens don't get much time at all, the only charge left behind for the hydrogen is what?
It's the positive.
Is the positive, yep, and there you go. That strange little squiggly symbol is a lowercase delta. It's a Greek D, and that little squiggly thing indicates that we have a polar covalent bond taking place. Okay, that is the need-to-know information. Anytime you see the little squiggly deltas, delta negative and delta positive, that says, hey, I am a polar covalent bond. And one of our best examples is water. By the way, if you're looking for water, it's on the top of page 10. So you may wonder why we're spending all this time in an anatomy class talking about chemistry. And this is a very important reason that we discuss polar covalent molecules like water. Going back to what we initially started with today, about how much of your body is made of water?
65%.
Yeah, 65%. So there's a good deal of this polar covalent molecule stuff floating around in you. And your plasma membranes are made up of oil or lipids. So you probably heard that oil and water don't mix, right? Okay, that means that polar covalent molecules like water do not behave well. They don't get along with nonpolar covalent molecules like oils or lipids. So there has to be a way for our bodies not to basically fall apart like Italian dressing, right? They don't separate to oil and water. There must be a way for the oil and the water to get along and behave. So that's going to be something we explore as we go throughout the next two courses. Okay, so let me emphasize something that may not be quite so noticeable in these pictures. When we do covalent bonding, we share in pairs. In this picture of the two hydrogen atoms, there are two electrons that are being shared equally between those two hydrogen nuclei. When we talked about water, again, we share in pairs. We always have two electrons being shared, or four, or six. So that's just the nature of how the covalent bond works. We're going to share in pairs. There's a shorthand that we can do instead of drawing out this massive atom and all the relationship every time we talk about water. We can actually use some chemical lines here to illustrate what we're talking about. So middle of page 10, let me take you there. All right, so before we talk about the shorthand, can you tell me that this is a covalent or an ionic bond?
Covalent,
good. And how do you know?
Because the carbon and hydrogen atoms are sharing their electrons.
Good, and we're sharing in pairs like we expect, right? Do you see any delta symbols?
No.
Okay, so delta symbols are a red flag that say I am polar. Okay. So this one is non-polar. There's no delta symbols there. So I don't want to draw this every time I talk about methane. Methane is CH4. There's one carbon and four hydrogens around it. And instead of drawing out all of this mess, we can use these lines to illustrate the bond. A single line means a single covalent bond. And a single covalent bond is a pair of electrons. I want you to think about shoes when you think about covalent bonds. When you try on a pair of shoes or when you buy shoes, you don't just buy one shoe. Just give me the right one. I don't want the left one. You know, you take both of the shoes. So covalent bonds occur in pairs. A single line is a single covalent bond, but in fact is a pair of electrons. Okay? So when you're looking at this picture on the right, there is a single line for every pair of electrons being shared. Let's talk about a different type. Do you agree that this is a covalent bond?
Yeah.
Yes.
How do you know?
Share in pairs.
Share in pairs, yeah. And there's one pair, and there's your second pair, okay? So these oxygens are experiencing what's called a double bond, meaning how many covalent bonds are occurring here?
Two.
Good. And of course, two covalent bonds means that there is in total how many electrons?
Four.
Exactly. So if you've got two pairs of shoes, you actually have four individual shoes. This is a little stronger of a bond because there's more electron being shared between those two atoms. And by the way, is this one polar or non-polar?
Non-polar.
Good. So this is how you write it. You put what looks like an equal sign between the two atoms, and that equal sign represents our double bond. It's really not an equal sign. It just looks like one. Gets kind of messy when you're sharing three pairs of electrons. Three pairs should be represented by how many lines?
Three.
Good. Really strong bond because you've got six total electrons being shared. And this picture over here, N with three lines drawn to M, is in fact a triple bond holding together those two nitrogen atoms. Okay. Do you feel pretty comfortable with covalent versus ionic? I'm not seeing a lot of yeses. Let's go through some review, make sure you're okay. All right, so all of these pictures here with the sticks drawn between all the hydrogens and carbons, covalent or ionic?
Covalent.
All of them are covalent. If you've got three lines between two atoms, what does that tell you?
That's a triple covalent bond.
Triple covalent bond, good. If you've got only one line,
single covalent.
Two lines?
Double.
Good. I see no delta symbols. That tells me what?
They're
all nonpolar, right? They're all sharing equally or unequally?
Equally,
yeah. Okay. Feel good about this picture? Okay. Let's do some review. Okay. So what do you think? Ionic or covalent?
Ionic.
Good. How do you know it is ionic?
Transferred, yeah.
And even though they don't give you the number of protons to count, they do give you a great clue. There it is. So which one of these is your cation?
Sodium.
Good. And you know that because?
Positive charge.
Good. That plus sign tells you you've lost electrons. And of course, the negative sign tells us that chlorine is an anion. Okay. Let's see. Covalent or ionic?
Covalent.
And how do you know? Sharing, good. And each carbon-hydrogen relationship has single, double, or triple bonds.
Single.
And you know this because? Yeah, there's two electrons, and that is a pair, right? Okay, so there's a pair being shared, and another pair, and another pair. All right. Covalent, ionic?
Covalent,
good. How do you know?
Sharing.
Those lines indicate sharing. Good. Do you see mostly single, double, or triple bonds here?
Mostly single, but one double.
Yeah, mostly single. All right. What do you think about this bond?
Covalent.
Good. And you know this because?
Sharing.
Good. Single, double, or triple bond?
Double.
How do you know?
Because there's two pairs.
Two pairs. Pair there and a pair there. So if we were to write this, by the way, these are oxygens, how many lines would I use between them?
Two.
Good. All right. Covalent or ionic?
Covalent.
Good. And you know this because?
Sharing.
Good. Each carbon and fluorine relationship is a single, double, or triple bond?
Single.
And you would represent that using how many lines?
One line.
Good. Okay. Feeling okay so far about covalent ionic?
Yes.
Okay. Something kind of weird is a hydrogen bond, and that's on the bottom of page 10. Do you recognize anything about this picture?
Deltas,
good. What else do you recognize?
Sharing.
Yeah, sharing electrons.
Positive.
Good, okay. Why don't we start with this water molecule here? We know it's a water molecule. There's an oxygen and two hydrogens. You did recognize the deltas, which means that we have a polar or non-polar covalent molecule.
It's polar.
And what that means is electrons are being shared
unevenly.
Good. Do you remember who was the greedy atom in this relationship?
The oxygen.
Good. All right, so we actually have two water molecules, and you'll notice that there's a dotted line going between the hydrogen on one of those molecules and the oxygen on the neighboring molecule. The delta positive charge is creating a slight attraction to a delta negative charge. It's a weak attraction, but nonetheless, it is enough to keep those water molecules attracted to each other. This is called hydrogen bonding, and it's because hydrogen, with a slight positive charge, is attracted to a neighboring water molecule with a slight negative charge. Does it have to be a neighboring water molecule, or can it be just anything with a slight charge to it? Actually can be anything. Yeah, so it may be water, it may be another polar molecule, maybe an alcohol molecule, but anything that's polar, that hydrogen's going to be slightly attracted to it. So we represent the hydrogen bond by using a dotted line, and that should help us not be confused, because back here when we talked about single double covalent bonds, we used a solid line. Okay, so no dotted lines when we talked about covalent bonding. So anytime you see a dotted line connecting two molecules together, we're going to say that's a hydrogen bond. Weak or strong?
Weak.
Yep.
Oh, so that means they're kind of like floating around each other, not stuck together, but floating around, because the other one has like eight already. So what does that mean?
Oh, they're stable. Yeah, they're stable.
So, but they're not, those two sets are not like together.
They're not going to completely track, like they may be bonded for a minute and then they may break off, and it may bond to another for a minute and may break off. So that bonding is enough to make them stick together temporarily. Yeah.
It's
not permanent, yeah.
Wait, okay. But how would they stick together if they did? You know,
if we're water molecules, I might stick to her for a minute, and a force may bump me, and I might now come up here and stick to her for a minute. But it has to do with input of energy that has to break those bonds. So if it's hot, it's more likely to break the bonds. If it's cold, it's more likely to form the bonds.
Well, I mean, because that one has eight, right? So, you know, maybe like that one's stable, and then that other one has two. So where would that one attract to the other one?
It has nothing to do with stability.
Oh.
Yeah, it only has to do with the fact that you've got a polar molecule attracted to another polar molecule. So, yeah, like a magnet. Yeah. But the stability issue is not really the focus for a hydrogen bond, because that's taken care of internally in the molecule. Yeah. So, like, we've looked at, we looked at a couple pictures earlier that had deltas on it. Anything with delta symbols that's somewhat slightly polarized, water molecules say, snap, I'm going to stick to you. So, it's not the internal structure, but yeah, I see where you're going with that. Okay, so in our review, there you've got a hydrogen bond, weak attraction, okay? I think that takes us down there to the bottom of the page. Any questions so far on page 10? Hey, that's a great stopping point. I think you guys are probably comfortable with page 11. If you will look through page 11 as homework, let me know if you have any questions. I'll be happy to address those on Monday. And then what we're going to plan to do on Monday is start with page 14. All right, y'all have a great weekend.